Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me in a bit will be Candace LaPage as we tackle this week's review. Still doing the show remotely, as you may hear and notice. The traffic outside my window today is pretty heavy. here in the west end of Guelph, just next to the Hanlon Expressway, still recording the show. Don't know when we'll be back at the studio, but that seems par for the course these days. Still so many unknowns. Would love to see the inside of those studios again, but that's not entirely up to me. And of course, in the meantime, we will continue to make do. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new French-Canadian action thriller The Decline, which you can now stream on Netflix. Been hitting the Netflix pretty hard lately, so we may have to go with another streaming service next week. That's not entirely up to me, but we'll see what happens. For the first part of the show, well, we're going to observe that, well, this is the 150th show of End Credits. We've been doing this for 3 years. Last week was officially kind of the start of year four of the show. But, you know, I'm going to spend the first part of this week sort of talking about where we've been, what all we've sort of looked at on the show, and some of the broader themes we've seen in the news that we've covered and in the movies we've talked about. It's amazing how quickly 3 years goes by. but, you know, one of the things I found is, you know, is you've been, when you do things on a weekly basis and you kind of build your workflow around deadlines, you know, and Monday you have to get this done, on Tuesday you have to get this done, on Wednesday the show is on the air. It's pretty easy to get lost in the routine, I guess. I first want to say, well, thanks to Candace, Tim, and Peter for still being here. They were here at the beginning and have been great about keeping up with the show through quarantine and keeping up with the rigors and the schedules and rolling with the punches. And it's been really, really great. It's been really, really easy still to put the show together and keep pumping it out on a weekly basis. And I know that's a challenge that a lot of programmers at CFRU have had to tackle over the last several weeks. And you know, the team I have helping me out has certainly made it easier. I also want to say thanks to Jenna Gare, Jesse Malott, and Vince Masson, who have been part of the shows at different times, have been co-hosts. You know, life took them away, sadly, and all I'm left with is the memories, as it were. But, you know, they've all been essential parts of the show, and it has been great. And, you know, they are missed, and I just want to add, like, at the start of the year, I was kind of thinking about trying to bring a couple of more co-hosts on, or at least one more co-host on, to sort of, you know, have a nice quartet again. And you know, this happened, COVID happened, and, it, you know, it hasn't been sort of a high priority to recruit, so, you know, if you're interested in the show, interested in community radio, period, and, you know, feel like you can contribute, by all means, reach out, and I always tell you how at the end of every week. Now, as to, well, the, you know, what we've been looking at the last 3 years, I went back and I called up the page for the first episode back on June the 7th, 2017. And it was Wonder Woman. We reviewed Wonder Woman that week. Interestingly, Wonder Woman 1984, which is the sequel, was supposed to come out this past Friday. And theoretically, we might have been doing that as a review if it had come out. I think it's now scheduled for sometime in August. However, I was looking at the news items that we covered that week too, and it seems like freaky looking back that it's kind of foreshadowing a lot of the themes that have come up repeatedly in the course of covering the news and covering pop culture in the last 3 years of the show. So just to recap what we talked about on that first show, we had three topics. The first topic was the disappointing box office of big sequels and IP-driven movies like Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales, and Baywatch, and how the supposedly bad reviews on Rotten Tomatoes lent to those movies failing at the box office. The other story was Jessica Chastain, the actress Jessica Chastain, was on the jury of the Cannes Festival that year and was highly critical of the roles for women in front of the camera and the lack of female participation behind the camera, because that year Sofia Coppola became the second woman in the festival's history to win Best Director. And then the third news item was a story about the Alamo Drafthouse, a theater chain in the United States of art house kind of cinemas where you get a meal while you're watching a movie, kind of like the Apollo Cinema up in Kitchener, which probably was inspired by the Alamo Drafthouse, not vice versa. But having said that, it was there was a story about how the Alamo Drafthouse was hosting women-only screenings of Wonder Woman, I should say, and how that seemed to upset a lot of men, the idea that there would be a screening of Wonder Woman with no men allowed, and how they were pretty angry. And so sort of like in that first week, you have encapsulated everything, not everything, but certainly some of the big things that have driven movie news in the 3 years we've been doing the show. It's interesting that, you know, you have Jessica Chastain talking about the roles of women in the movie industry, and this is June 2017, and it was just a few months later, about 4 months later, that Me Too hits, that the stories about Harvey Weinstein come out, and then, you know, you had the domino effect there. You had, you know, John Lasseter, you had Kevin Spacey, you had Matt Lauer, you had Louis C.K., you had, what's his name from CBS, Charlie Rose, just on and on down the list, even to things like Nixxiom, which, you know, involved a Hollywood component too, because the actress Allison Mack from Smallville was involved in recruiting women for this guy, who they called the Vanguard. I can't remember his real name, but I remember Vanguard. Just like this sudden outpouring of years and years of offenses and cover-ups. And it was so weird for that. I remember saying at the during the fall of 2017, it's like, I started end credits to get away from serious news like this. And the world of pop culture ended up being this very, very serious this very, very serious movement called Me Too, and then later Time's Up. And from that, like, there was a whole series of things. You know, even in the world of, like, film review, Harry Knowles was thrown off his own site because of allegations against him. Devin Faraci was, cut off from all his various projects, you know, including Fantastic Fest, because of allegations against him of harassment and intimidation. All the Money in the World famously cut Kevin Spacey completely out of the film and recast it and reshot everything that he was in 6 weeks before the movie came out. Incredible. Just an incredible series of events that happened. And, you know, we're still kind of dealing with this. And just to go back to what Jessica Chastain said, we're still dealing with having so much trouble getting the attention of are giving women attention they deserve. This past year's Oscars, prime example of that, where you had 5 Best Director nominees, none of them women, even though it was an incredibly great year for women directors, whether you're talking about Greta Gerwig for Little Women, Lorraine Scafaria for Hustlers, Lulu Wang for The Farewell, Muriel Heller for A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. You know, you could just go down the list and check stuff off, and any one of those women would have been appropriate choices for Best Director. Would have been nice if a few of them had gotten the nod, as opposed to, you know, people like Tarantino and Scorsese, who have gotten their day and have gotten their awards. That's not to say their movies were bad, but, you know, you certainly couldn't have had Hustlers without Scorsese, but, you know, the fact that, you know, you did have Lorraine Scafaria making a movie that was very much in the Scorsese mold, it does make you wonder. Hustlers, directed by Scorsese, does that get a nomination? I think a lot of people think it probably would, but it did not go Scafaria's way, which is a shame. You know, to look too at the story about the Wonder Woman screenings, the ladies-only Wonder Woman screenings, makes you think about the whole thing about inclusion, the harassment of women online. It makes me think about the whole thing about Star Wars and Kelly Marie Tran and Daisy Ridley, two of the female stars of the Star Wars sequel trilogy, forced off social media because of nonstop harassment. It makes me think of the year before with the Ghostbusters, the all-female Ghostbusters. That was such a front to all mankind, according to some quarters. You know, still, you know, causing rancor amongst some people. Like, how dare Paul Feig had made this movie? Also, you have a direct reaction to that in the Ghostbusters Afterlife, which is a movie that's still going to come out at some point. I believe it's scheduled for 2021 now. But I find myself still dubious of this film because it feels like a response to people who are outraged about the all-female Ghostbusters. It's like, okay, we're going to do something cool where you don't have to see all women again. Heaven forbid you see all women as heroes in this movie. And you come back to what happened with Star Wars recently. You had Rise of the Skywalker, which seemed made in such a way that it was supposed to address these critiques from very loud but ultimately very small-minded people on Twitter and other social media platforms. We're going to mitigate the Kelly Marie Tran's role. You're hardly ever going to see her. She's still there because we have to acknowledge her, but she's not going to be in it too terribly much. It just seems like toxic fandom is a story that we have talked about, but it is something that is a constant and has been a constant this whole time. And of course, playing that into other things like the Hollywood obsession with franchises. It's interesting to go back to 2017 and this story about terrible reviews and for these big studio movies and studios investing so much time, effort, and energy in these very mediocre movies that are meant to get just tons of people to the theater. We're going to take your money. We don't really care about the story we give you. And this is sort of like a recurring theme every summer. And I remember talking about this last summer on one of our shows where there was a news report or somebody wrote an article, I think, for Forbes that it was a really bad summer for sequels because you had Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and all these other sequels and franchise movies that kind of crashed and burned, were not as successful as people thought they were going to be, and they, you know, supposedly that was the end of the situation. Hollywood should focus more on originality. Of course, that hasn't turned out to be true. It never turns out to be true, but one of the things I think that has come out of all this is no more talk of everything has an expanded universe. The week after our first review, our second review was of The Mummy, which was was kind of the death knell of this idea of we're going to expanded universize everything. And we have all these movies lined up with big stars playing the monsters, and it's all going to come together in this, you know, expanded universe package where all the movies tie into other movies, and it never materialized because the first movie you make sucks and does not attract the attention you want. We seem to have very little of that talk anymore. You know, Bumblebee was the last Transformers movie. That's done. You know, The Mummy was the, you know, they've since gone on to make The Invisible Man, and Ryan Gosling's been attached to a Wolfman movie, so they're moving on with that. Even the DC movies, which are still kind of ostensibly all tied together, are now kind of going off and doing their own thing and not really thinking about how this connects into this and how this leads into Justice League 2. And of course, you know, kind of emblematic of all these issues is, as I was talking about last week, the Snyder Cut of Justice League. There's your toxic fandom. There's your obsession with extended universes, because Justice League was going to kick off all these things. The Henry Lennox character from Man of Steel, it was going to turn out he's the Martian Manhunter, and we're going to introduce Darkseid. And that's going to lead us into Justice League 2, where this nightmare sequence in Batman versus Superman is finally going to pay off and all that stuff. And so, you know, I could care less. But one thing we should all care about, to sort of bring this back to reality as we go into our musical break, is the overwhelming concern about people of color, black people, indigenous people, and police violence. There was a big protest here in Guelph this past weekend. You may have seen some of the pictures. You may have seen some of my own coverage. And it was huge. Thousands of people downtown marching in support of Black Lives Matter and anti-police or police violence, marching against police violence. And it was an impressive sight, to be sure. Part of that was Andrew Craig, who is a renowned musician and performer. He has performed twice for Nelson Mandela, so you know he is top shelf when it comes to Canadian musical talent. He is from Guelph, and he is just such a great singer, such a great performer. And I'm going to share a bit of that from the protest this past weekend. This is a live performance by Andrew Craig of A Change Is Gonna Come, famous Sam Cooke song, highly appropriate for the occasion, I think, and touchingly performed by Andrew Craig. And we're going to roll that out now and come back with our review of The Decline. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. Knocking me back down on my knees. Well, there were times when I thought I wouldn't last for long, but now I think I'm able to carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Thank you, Sam.
Grocery shops in cities like Montreal are stocked for 3 days. That means after 3 days, if the delivery trucks don't come by, there won't be anything left.
That's why I'm doing this tutorial on Mylar.
In case it's a crashed economy, or if the planet gets even warmer, there will be lots of hungry people, but not us.
And don't forget, in order to live, you have to survive.
I want to explain what a temporary autonomous survival zone is.
I have 6 solar panels that give us 2600 watts.
Is a chicken coop. Over there, a greenhouse. Both are heated.
These are what I call the evacuation trails in case I'm attacked.
To be clear, those paths are made for morning stroll.
Protecting your resources and your territory is the key to survival in times of chaos.
You have to know that not everyone has your common sense. Some of them will try to steal everything you have. And when it happens, I don't want my life to change.
Afraid?
And that was a clip from The Decline. It is the new film from Patrice Laliberté. And it stars Réal Bossé, Marc-André Grodin, Isabelle Giraud, Marilyn Costaguay, Mark Beaupré, Marie Eveline Lazard, and Guillaume Cyr.
I am now being joined on the line by Candace Lepage. And Candace, how are you doing today?
I'm all right. Still safe at home, like we have been for the last 12 or 13 weeks.
I know, it's incredible. All of April's shows were these quarantine shows, all of May's shows. This is the second show of June. For people who are listening and wondering what's kind of going on behind the scenes of CFRU, it's weird because I don't think in sort of the internal communications of all the volunteers and the staff of the station, we are like saying, when do we get back into the station? Doing our shows from home seems to be going relatively well.
Yeah, it's great that CFRU, and I don't know when they started making these sorts of changes, but have been able to you know, sort of deal with mobile radio content delivery, which is great.
Yeah, we may never go back to the station.
I don't want to never go back. But I will say, you know, it might take time before I want to share a microphone with someone.
Oh, that's true too.
When I'll ever go back to karaoke.
We were talking about the Black Lives Matter Black Lives Matter march before we started recording, and I was standing up front, so I did notice every time someone new was speaking, they sprayed the microphone with some sort of disinfectant or something before each new person took the microphone. So that could be a glimpse at things to come.
Yes, yeah, and I'm sure there are certain styles of microphone that are going to be much better suited for quick disinfecting between persons.
Yeah, it could be a thing too, and this is kind of getting way off topic, but you know, we have the mufflers that go on the microphones.
The foam hats.
The foam hats, yeah, you know, those aren't easy to clean. Mm-mm. So do we like, is there like maybe a cottage industry of somewhere of like disposable foam hats, where each time you leave the studio, you take off your foam hat and throw it away so the next person can put on a new foam hat. That may be food for thought.
Yep. I mean, yeah, everything is food for thought, unfortunately. Our life has pretty fundamentally changed. So, you know, we have an opportunity to change lots of things, and some of them for good and some of them for excess waste.
Well, that sounds like a good segue for The Decline, which is the movie we're reviewing this week. It is the first product of the production deal between Canada and Netflix. It is the first Canadian film produced specifically for Netflix. It is French-Canadian. The co-hosts are choosing the titles, and this was Candace's choice. And I will begin by letting you, Candace, talk about why you wanted to recline into The Decline.
Most of it is really sort of right there in your introduction to the movie. We have been watching quite a few sort of Netflix originals and sort of chatting about the quality and in some ways the speed at which they've been able to bring them out, the cost, you know, what kinds of things Netflix is going to be creating in the future. We haven't really talked so much about where they're being created. So I was pretty interested in this production deal with Canada to begin with. I am certainly a fan of Canadian movies. My national artistic pride has gone pretty far back. I have often taken time to learn more about Canadian movies and Canadian television and, you know, how it's created, where the money comes from. I'm a big fan of the Canucksploitation era of sort of horror films. I was really interested in seeing what the product of this deal would be. I will take this opportunity to say I definitely do, in general, I like the CRTC and the fact that, you know, broadcasters, whether it be television or radio, have certain sort of quota, which is a bad word, but quota that they have to meet to, you know, have Canadian content. I am okay with the fact that Netflix doesn't have that, because I think it's a really difficult conversation to have, and maybe, you know, goes too far when it becomes applied to a lot of things. I like the fact that they have this production deal. I do really, really, really wish that they had to charge us tax, our, you know, service tax as Canadians on their service. I would gladly pay that 13%. Well, I guess it's, I don't even remember which one is the breakdown. I think it's 5% nationally and 8% yep. here in Ontario. I would gladly pay that monthly on my Netflix service. I am a Canadian. I am buying a Canadian service. I should have to pay the tax. but otherwise, I will say all the rest of it. I'm okay with all the decisions that ended up being made around Netflix in Canada, except for that one.
Well, somewhere in there, that movie review, there was a campaign commercial, but you're not wrong. And I think Netflix gets unfairly dinged as sort of being the, what did the president of CBC call it? Like, she said it was like imperialism. It was like the like old British imperialism. But the fact of the matter is, you know, Netflix has probably done more for CanCon than, heck, even, you know, the CBC to an extent. You know, Schitt's Creek, Anne with an E, those were both CBC shows, but they became international successes because of Netflix, and people were able to engage with them, who maybe didn't tune in on, you know, the day and date CBC played them and catch up with them later on Netflix, and become, you know, Emmy winning, or at least Emmy nominated success stories. If you think about, you know, Schitt's Creek, which scored, weirdly enough, Emmy nominations for Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara. the decline, though.
That was, like, I just knew that it was the first Canadian film on Netflix. I didn't even necessarily know what genre it was or anything, though I did certainly see the poster, which had a lot of snow in it, which made me very happy.
Well, we know how you feel about summer.
Down with summer.
Yeah, it's, I went into this not knowing anything about it either. One of the things I will say, just from a technical perspective, I put it on and it started playing with the English dub, which I hate.
I was not happy that was the automatic. I was like, whoa, wait, nope, stop right there.
Yeah.
I have learned that for the English dub, it is all of the same actors who are overdubbing their own French language, which doesn't make it any better for me, but maybe makes it better for other people who just don't want to read subtitles. I don't know.
to each their own. But yeah, I knowing that makes me a bit more okay with it. But having said that, you know, I have never. I've never been one of those people that's like, ew, reading at a movie. But yeah, it's... So, you know, once I got over that hurdle, I really got into this very, very quickly. And it's because, you know, thematically, it's very of the moment. And I'm not sure how quickly all this came together. I know that the decline did get a brief theatrical run in Quebec in February. But having said that, I'm not sure how long this was in the works. And
so I understand actually that the director, who I think also either did write the script or certainly was the story writer, came up with it in 2017. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that that's still close enough in time to be pretty relevant to what's going on right now. Oh, this very year.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there were a lot of anxieties coming off of, you know, whose election. But the movie is about preppers, doomsday preppers, and they go camping. Well, maybe not camping, but they go to a retreat of this guy, Alain, who puts together, I guess, prepping videos, like how to preserve your own food and how to get ready to stop the hordes who are going to come and try and take your stuff when society collapses. And so he's doing this retreat. Six people show up and they learn the ins and outs of bomb making and evasive tactics and burying go bags on your property. and then it all goes horribly, horribly wrong, as it was bound to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was interesting to me to watch how it went horribly wrong. Because, like, you know, as you said, as we both said, like, I really hadn't read anything about it at all, period. So I was pretty sure it was going to go at some point in time, something is going to happen. And so when it did happen, and basically the whole story turned on these six people against each other, really, as opposed to, you know, what you might have thought was going to happen originally, or even what they maybe thought would happen in this type of case as well. You know, that they would have to work together against some other force, but no, it's yeah, they got to work together against each other. It's a little Lord of the Flies.
Yeah, no, it's when you kind of get into the story and you get like a hint of like, okay, this is the setup, this is what's going on, you think you know where the story is going, and it does kind of go that way, but there's a lot of surprising nuance to that. And when people sort of, let's say, leave the film, it is always it is always like quick and shocking, and you're like, that's it, they're done, they're out. And I mean, with a couple of exceptions, there are a couple of like fairly long, gruesome and excruciating death sequences for a couple of them, but for the most part, the deaths are come across quite shocking. And you're right, the point of the story isn't, well, twofold. One is that these people can, you know, turn on themselves, to turn on each other on a dime, even after they have this sort of like elegant dinner in the cabin, where they're all like, you know what, we all get it, we understand that society's on like the knife's edge, and we're all friends, and we're gonna get through this together. And then as soon as like one thing goes wrong, any idea that we're in this together goes out the chute. But what also goes out the chute is the immediate reaction of all these rugged individualist prepper people is to call for help from the outside.
Yeah, I mean, which I definitely did find there was a little bit of irony there, but I also feel like in that moment, the people who did go, okay, no, we need to get help, had a personal sort of breakthrough where they went, oh, huh, okay, there are actually things that I can't do alone.
Right.
And I think, you know, I think it's important. I know a lot of people, you know, it's almost a cliche now. People talk about Henry David Thoreau's On Walden Pond.
I was talking about it myself the other day.
Yeah, and how, you know, it's the story about, you know, him spending time all by himself and becoming self-sufficient, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But when you look into the historical accuracy of it, and you realize, oh, well, you know, the land was on his family's land. He wasn't far from family. There were people helping each other out throughout. And that's important. I mean, I think it's, you know, in a way, we're talking about how relevant it is right now. You know, we're all staying home as a form of social good. You know, we're all staying home, an individual, to help everybody together. And I think it's really important that people remember that, you know, humanity has always survived in groups, And as much as I have, I worry about tribalism, I also totally understand where it comes from, because, you know, finding safety in a group of people is so important to our survival as humans.
Right. And I think the film also draws a distinction too, that I think a lot of people have experienced in the midst of the pandemic crisis. You know, there's this very world-changing situation going on right now, a global pandemic, and the culture has kind of acclimated us to the idea that when the pandemic came, things would just fall apart, and we would all be on our own, and we'd all have to arm ourselves, and society would be gone, and we couldn't trust anybody, and this is kind of the fantasy world these people in the film live in. And of course, I've heard this commentary in other places that, you know, a lot of the frustration of people who are like showing up at Capitol buildings with assault rifles is that the great fantasy, the great end of the world fantasy has kind of not happened. And that it, there's sort of a great mode of connectivity, collectivity, of working together, even while being apart. You know, there are no zombies wandering around. There's no reason to go get your gun. Just, you know, it's just a matter of, like, hunkering down, using your head, being smart. Society is still here. We are still interacting as a society. And the great fantasy of, you know, every man or woman for themselves never materializes. And, you know, and I think what the movie's trying to say is, too, is that that whole fantasy is kind of BS, even outside of what we're experiencing right now, because you have all these people who are preparing to, you know, shoot stationary targets and loading weapons and building bombs, but at the end of the day, they don't know basic first aid. Because there's the one woman who gets shot in the leg, and it's like they don't know how to treat. And it's like, well, you know, in a, like a situation where you are kind of fighting for your life and for your property, have you not accepted that it's a possibility that you or someone else in your team might get shot at? And might get hit.
Or just injured in some way, period.
In some way, like fall and break a leg as you're trying to cut down a tree, or, you know, you swing the axe and it misses the log and you nick your leg. And it just, you know, I guess it's a literal instance of, well, maybe not literal, but, you know, an instance of not seeing the forest for the trees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because all of the characters are quite different from each other, and they all have different reasons, I think, that they are taking part in any sort of like survival training and prepping. So not only do they have different reasons why they're personally doing it, you know, some are doing it to get over trauma, some are doing it just to feel, you know, their own personal sense of strength. They also all have different ideas of how their skills are going to have to, like, what is going to cause the cataclysm that forces them to, you know, move into this prep mode. Mm. And it's so interesting to me how each of the people is, one, so different from each other, but then how they act so different. Like, I definitely thought that a different character was going to be the cause of the problem.
Right.
I don't, it's hard to say because I don't really want to spoil too much because it's a small cast of characters. So we don't really want to, like, it is nice to see what happens and how things unfold. But yeah, there was definitely one character who, to me, like, immediately I was like, oh, this isn't going to go well. And it didn't go that way at all, which I thought was really interesting and refreshing.
Yeah, it turned, I think I know what you mean, because that instance, and I was thinking about this after the movie was over, it's like there's a bit of foreshadowing there, that there's a little moment of confrontation between two of the characters, and it's, you know, it's kind of like one of those things, it's like it's a little moment of social discomfort, and then it's over. And then it turns out to be, you know, a signal to where we're going to end up in an hour. And I did like that. What I like about the characters too, like, this is a very, I want to say, skinny movie, narratively speaking. It's like 85 minutes.
Yeah, it is tight. Very tight.
It's like survivalist filmmaking. It's only what we need. I like that a lot, and you do get like very subtle hints about, you know, the different reasons why people are there. Some, you know, and I imagine this is very reflective of real life too, is, you know, some people have been traumatized by something, and this has been written about a lot too, about, you know, where we are right now is that, you know, people searching for some form of control. And this is another reason why people sort of embrace conspiracy theories and things. They can't control, say, when their significant other gets brain cancer, but they can gather intelligence on all these conspiracy theories that say 5G cell towers cause brain cancer, because that gives you someplace you can direct your energy. The main character, what I found interesting too, is that, you know, the start of the movie, we're introduced to this Alan character and his family, and they're doing like a practice evacuation, him and his wife and his, not say his wife, but his partner and their child. And it's like they live in this nice home. They seem to, you know, kind of not want for anything. And it makes you wonder, like, what is this person concerned about? And that's never really explored. But, I mean, you're allowed to sort of fill it with your sort of own imagination. And the film does that a lot. You know, what happens from the end is sort of an interesting question, too. And you know, where the surviving characters end up. But, you know, to look at the Alan character, not Alan, he's the teacher guy. Antoine, I think I'm, yeah. Antoine, because, you know, there's a nice scene, actually, that I found kind of cute, where they're watching one of Alan's videos about how to preserve your own food, and him and his daughter are doing it together, like it's some sort of, like, little craft project, and, it, you know, it makes me, anyway, just from my own personal perspective, makes me sort of, like, pause for a minute. It's like, okay, maybe this whole idea of, like, we have to prepare for the end, because it's absolutely coming, maybe isn't as toxic as it seems. And I just find it interesting that, you know, in this family, which seems to be a fairly well-off family, they are absolutely paranoid that everything they have could go away, and like this the serenity of this, you know, preparing how to preserve your food for preserve rice for 20 years. We could eat this rice in 20 years, he says to his daughter. It's at once reaffirming, but it's also disturbing, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I do think there is a certain amount of being prepared for an emergency that all of us, I'll say all of us in Canada, but maybe it's you know, across North America, that all of us could be better at. I mean, even just in looking at what's happened over the last, 12 or 13 weeks, early on in the beginning, when it was clear that people were going to be asked to stay home and to only go out, you know, for groceries once a week and only buy essentials, the number of people who just did not have some basic pantry staples at home,
yeah,
is a large number. And, you know, a big part of that, like, there's a whole political and social reason why that is, but, you know, have rice, have dried beans, have pasta, you know, there are some, you know, tins of tuna, all, you know, jars of peanut butter or some other sort of nut butter. Like, there are some really just sort of simple things that we should all probably be a little bit better at. So I think, you know, with his character, he was maybe going a little bit further and not sure why that is, but I suspect that most of it was, you know, sort of based in, one, having a family and wanting to make sure that his, his daughter is safe, and two, listening to the news too much. I mean, he was sort of the character who really felt like, and I don't necessarily disagree with him, but felt like climate change and like climate refugees are really going to make a significant impact on his life and on all of our lives. And, you know, when they were doing their practice run, they had the news on, and the news was talking about, you know, like H1N1 and other viruses. So it feels like he just surrounds himself with all of these sort of potential end of the world news things, which has just sort of slowly crept up from wanting to protect his child, which I think is an incredibly strong thing that parents have. So, you know, something that started small just grew into more than it should have. But even still, you know, throughout the movie, and one point, he was the one who did sort of talk about including other people in, you know, sort of the plan.
Mm-hmm.
The like, you know, there could be other people we can learn from. There could be other people we can get help from. So,
right.
I think he's the character we all want to say we are.
Yeah, the movie's a warning in a lot of ways. I do hear that message. The Antoine character, you're right, he maybe spends a little too much time in the company of the news, which I get myself. But yeah, there's a warning between how much do you live in the sheer tonnage of concern that there is in the world, and how much of it is, I guess, where is the fine line between being prepared and being delusionally prepared? And that, you know, that's kind of scary too. And I think there's also hints in this of, you know, the scariness of people who claim to have all the answers, because, you know, there are a lot of these scenes. And the movie kind of lulls you into a false sense of security. It makes you forget it's a thriller, or that there's, you know, like, dangerous things coming, that, you know, they form this nice group, this enclave. And in the back of my mind the whole time was, though, the six guests are sleeping in this tent in winter while he's up in this opulent cottage, with his piano and his books and his running water. And, you know, there's something very cultish about it as well. And there's a warning in there about people who claim to have all the answers. And and as the film wears on, there's definitely a deconstruction that, you know, this guy, despite, you know, taking it upon himself to be sort of their leader, is making it up as he goes along, as much as the rest of them are.
Yeah, I mean, there were certainly a lot of times that sort of crept in, but I think it was, you know, so evident when he is yelling at everybody else, saying, not a single one of you is being logical or calm right now. Nobody's being rational. None of you are ready for, you know, this life that you're trying to prepare for, which are all probably true things, but the way that he delivered that information to them was certainly not through calm, rational communication. Like, he lost it, and was just very angry at them. I guess, you know, who knows, maybe he was disappointed because he felt. And I think that there was some disappointment there, because he did seem to really take quite a liking to some of those characters. And so when, you know, he saw them devolving, I guess, which from his point of view, I don't know that they were devolving, but from his point of view, that they were, you know, moving away from him, he was disappointed and hurt by it, and then had an emotional outburst. And it's like, okay, so how come you're allowed to be yelly and angry and not talking rationally? Does that mean you're not prepared for it either? which is probably true.
Right. It's, you know, it's the ultimate lesson about the best laid plans. And, you know, it all it takes is one person to get blown up to ruin, you know, your nice survivalist weekend.
Just a nice camping trip. I don't know how it's got to go so bad.
Right. It's funny the things that, you know, this little movie can sort of make you think about, and it's elegant. It's small, it's elegant. It's kind of like how I like my Canadian movies is, you know, you can do big things on little budgets, and you can create things that can surprise you and that are, you know, terribly rewarding as you think back upon it. And I think my fear is that some silly American producer is going to see this while they're on lockdown and think, I know, I'm going to remake this in English and with more money and starring one of the kids from The Maze Runner or something. and it's, you know, I think it's going to go just that badly, because I think this movie works very, very well as it is. It made me think about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre too. Not that they're very similar in tone, but you know, there's isolation, there are group dynamics, you know, there's, you know, survivalism. One is a winter climate, the other is kind of like a desert climate, but it just reminds me that budget isn't everything. And you can be very, very effective just by having a group of people in the middle of nowhere and having sort of like strong characterization. And I won't say that this is Canada's Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but it is just a reminder that you do not need big budgets, big stars, to do big things or have big ideas. It's the movie of the moment, and that's kind of incredible, because I don't think Patrice, how am I going to say his last name? La Liberté, yeah. I was sort of trying to pronounce it to myself either, but then I forgot myself. But yeah, Patrice La Liberté, I don't think he was thinking about the condemnations that were going to come to this when this movie hits Netflix in June 2020, but it happens. It happens.
Yeah, and just really quickly, I will say Netflix did say after the first weekend that it was available that it had 21 million streams, which is, you know, a pretty good number. Mm-hmm. And apparently 95% of those were not in Canada on that first weekend. So,
wow. And Netflix is very, very guarded about its numbers. There would have definitely made an impact for them to have gone out of their way to say how many people had watched this. So I think that bodes well for La Liberté and his team. I'm not sure it bodes well for my dream of not seeing this remade in Hollywood fashion.
Yeah, I don't know how to help you with that one. Sorry.
All right. Well, maybe you can help people by telling them how they can find you on the internet.
Yeah, you can find me on the internet.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. If you'd like to listen to it again,
you can pretty much put that into any social network and you will find me.
You can download us at the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back on CFRU Thursday at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to my political site at guelphpolitico.ca. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.